Jyoti, welcoming you to the From Surviving to Thriving Creativity and Mental Health podcast series. These podcast series are designed and delivered by the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance and funded by the Bearing Foundation. These podcast series were born on the back of a research report co-written by Victoria Hume from the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance and myself. And the report's main focus has been on developing a model that helps us build a sustainable practice in arts and mental health. As part of these podcast series, we are hoping to dive deeper into this model and discuss its recommendations focused on five core groups: practitioners, commissioning organizations, funders, researchers, and infrastructure organizations. On this episode, we are going to be focusing on the recommendations for practitioners and what the report means to practitioners within the arts, culture, and health space. And to that extent, I am super excited to be joined by two absolutely brilliant practitioners who've got years of experience between them. And I'm very, very charged up to have a chat with them and dive deeper into this report. So a very warm welcome to Daniel Regan and Sue Flowers. Firstly, thank you very much, Daniel and Sue, for joining in. I'm going to start off by asking both of you to share a little bit more about yourself and what you do. Daniel, would you like to kickstart on this?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me here today. So I'm Daniel. I am a photographic artist, and I mainly produce works that are around health, and in particular mental health for somebody living with a mental health difficulty. And I also deliver lots of participatory works and supporting people living with various health concerns, both physical and mental health. And I do lots of consulting work in both the arts and the health sector.
Amazing to have you on board here, Danielle. Sue, how about you?
Hi, my name's Sue Flowers. I'm based in North Lancashire. I'm an artist and I run an arts organisation called Green Close. My practice is very much based around the health and wellbeing of our relationship with the environment and our interconnectivity with each other.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Sue. So I think one of the amazing things about being practitioners is the fact that, you know, there's a lot going on within our head and outside as well. We tend to wear multiple hats, working, dipping in and out of projects. So I would love to know, what does a normal day at work look like? And if that's too complicated a question, then I would love to find out a little bit more about some of the projects that you are currently working on. So Sue, why don't you kickstart on this one?
Thanks, Minati. Well, my diary is in front of me. I was wondering which day to pick. There is no such thing as a normal day, but every day is very rich and diverse and sometimes quite complicated. So I think at the heart of what certainly my last 5 years, I've really been trying to focus on how I look after my own well-being as well as the well-being of others. I've recently just finished a program, a Thriving Communities program called Phoenix Rising, which has involved art, nature and movement, a program of that to support people's well-being. We've worked a lot with former addicts and people with mental health conditions on that programme, and we're now trying to fundraise and make it more sustainable. Wednesday I was over in Pendle mentoring some artists that are working on a arts for health programme, helping them just as an extra helping them look after themselves, but also just observing how venues are supporting them and how the program's generally going, if there's any issues, as there often is when people come together to think about their mental health and well-being. Yesterday I had a massive clear out with a friend in the studios because I've been incredibly busy and I've been toing and froing and dropping kind of lots of materials. We've had an exhibition at Morecambe Library of the work we've been doing with people there. And today I'm talking to you. So yeah, a really quite a diverse work. Yesterday I was talking to Lancashire Recovery College about doing some work on the wards and for staff at Lancashire Care. So there's usually a mixture of delivery development and then that a whole space for other things that are peripheral to that, such as managing budgets and sorting out other people that I'm working with. And then somewhere in the corner is my own creative practice, and that's something I need to nurture.
Thank you for sharing some really diverse projects there you're working on. Danielle, how about you?
Much like Sue, I have a very rich and diverse calendar. I always find this question really interesting because I think when people ask me, what do I do? And I say, I'm an artist. And then I say, what I've been doing all day. They say, oh, that's not what I thought you'd be doing. People still have this very traditional idea that I'm in my studio painting all day, which is not what I'm doing. I'm often sat at my computer doing lots and lots of prep, which is mainly writing lots and lots of funding applications. And I feel like the actual delivery of my activities are the smallest part, but the richest part. So I'm often writing funding applications. I do lots of consultancy work. I take time out to make sure that I'm doing something creative myself. So, for example, yesterday, as I've not been feeling 100%, I made some time in my calendar to sit and do some painting, to reflect on where I want to be going in the next 6 months. And I've also been thinking about a project that I'm working on in the next couple of weeks called If Homes Had Ears, which is working with an LGBT charity called Opening Doors London, that supports older LGBT people, working with the British Library. And we're going to be exploring sounds of the home and thinking about what home means to us through sound. So my day-to-day in terms of my life as an artist is different every day, just like Sue's, working on lots and lots of different projects, which is just how I want it. I don't like a routine or a 9-to-5. I like to be working on as many different things as possible to keep things fresh.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing, Daniel. And I love the sound of that project. I think also often, as both of you have pointed out, you know, it can be a struggle to sort of keep nurturing that personal practice of yours. I, at least personally, as an artist myself, I find that the hardest to do. Whereas when I do it, I feel that that's really helping me as a person to be well and then obviously serve the communities as well. So just touching upon that about, you know, how do you make sure that arts and creativity helps you with your mental health as well? Could you highlight any specific example? Daniel, I'm going to start off with you on this one.
Absolutely. I mean, I came into this sector because I discovered photography as a way to manage my feelings as a young person. So it's intrinsically linked into how I manage my own well-being, which is why I love working in this field and in the sector. And I still continue to use photography as a way to navigate and process all of the challenges that life throws at me. And that's what really took me into participatory work, thinking about my own experiences and how can I support other people. Something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently is that I'm a professional artist. That's what I do for work, and that's a real privilege to have that that career. But I felt like in the last couple of years I've been losing my connection to just making for making's sake, making as a way to process, because everything has become a job, which is, you know, fantastic. But I also want to make just to make things. They don't have to be for a brief or for work. And I guess there's two things that really stood out for me in the last couple of years, probably since the beginning of the pandemic, which was that I was in a meeting and someone used the phrase life-work balance instead of work-life balance. And just switching those two words around made me realise, actually, I work too much and I need to do more living. And one of the things that I love to do when I'm just living is creating and just making things, not making things for work, but just making and being creative. And the other thing was that I was spending some time with a friend and she was describing this story of when her child came home from school with a friend, and they were young, they were about 7 or 8. And this her son's friend came home and she asked him, you know, how was school today? And he said, oh, it was terrible. I didn't enjoy it. And she was saying, what would you have liked more of at school? And he said, golden time. And she said, what's golden time? And I said, what's golden time? And he said, oh, it's time where we just get to play. And I realized, actually, I need more golden time in my life. I need to just play. It needs to be unstructured. And I just need to create without it being tied to some kind of job. And so what I've been doing in the last 18 months is sometimes in my studio in the middle of the day, just making time in my calendar and literally putting in golden time. And I just sit and I draw or I paint or I sketch or I take photographs or I read a book or I listen to a podcast. And it's just play time for me to be creative. And that's so nourishing for my mental health. So I really encourage everybody to have more golden time in their life.
Daniel, I couldn't agree more. I'm gonna lift that golden time thought and keep it with me. I think
have it. I'm on a quest to like get golden time everywhere now.
It's so important to, and I think that's one of the reasons I like doing the work, because when I'm doing the delivery and in a group of people, rather than being like a bird of prey hovering over everyone, I'm in the room in an equal space with everybody, and it reminds me that I've got issues of my own and I need to look after myself. And I work and share my kind of, I think there's sometimes a perception that if you're a professional artist, you're going to do the best drawing in the room. And I really like to kind of remind people that, you know, that good drawings are a thing of our imagination, and that it's actually the process that that gives us the joy. So kind of liberating people from that sense of failure, and that also liberates me, because I remind myself when I'm working with people how important it is just to do the doing and the making. And I quite often, when I'm working with people, will deliberately slip with a piece of charcoal or a pen and go, oh no, what am I going to do? And I know it's quite scary for me, but I just kind of go, but look, I can do this. We can work on it, around it, through it, and make it our own. And that actually really nourishes me. It gives me a sense of reconnection with the power of that golden time, that playing and trusting in the process. And I have two relatives with bipolar disorder, and over the many years I've supported my mother, certainly I've witnessed a kind of disconnect between around communication between the people that are trying to support her and herself, in that she's not been able to always articulate how she's feeling or what her needs are. And again, with my other relative, I've watched this kind of quite sterile scenario where you're in a room, forced in a room, and someone's saying to you, so how are you today? And I've had conversations around, what did that mean? What did that actually mean? Was it since I saw you 6 months ago? And actually, I think through all the work I've done with communities, I just see that actually talking isn't always the right way to communicate, and people can communicate in lots of different ways, and the visual arts can really help people process where they are right now, and then through the kind of drawing and the wonderful distraction of making, sometimes words flow. And I just love to try, and so I've seen time and time again people not being able to articulate their feelings, and then because they're crafting with a piece of paper and a pair of scissors, they kind of, the barriers come down and they just start talking about things. And I've often thought it would be, to be able to place that within a clinical setting with whoever needs to know that information, is just a more human and a more natural way for us to approach the work.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've hit such a powerful sort of aspect of what we all do, is that communication, internal communication. I think the voice that sort of rings in your head, but also how you can communicate your feelings and your thoughts to everyone around you. And you're right, you know, sometimes just normal speaking is into this episode, please do. And absolutely agree with golden time, Daniel. I think that's going to be like a key message for me today. And for anybody who's listening into this, book in and block some time, some golden time in your diary. I think that's an amazing idea. And wise words by the little one. On that note, I think it's time for us to sort of dive in into the report. And one of the things that we have tried to focus on through this report is to make it relevant, to make it realistic, to make it holistic in all its aspects. So I want to start off by asking both of you, what has been your first impressions about this report and what have you found most useful? Sue, would you like to start us off on this one?
Yeah, I love the fact that it seemed very clear about all the kind of different stakeholders who's involved, these kind of five pillars that we're all in it together, and that if we, so those five pillars are funders, practitioners, commissioners, researchers, and infrastructure organisations. And I found that really useful to just think of in terms of, it's not, well, I know it's not just me and I'm not going alone, but I think when you're a freelancer and supporting other freelancers that work in this way, maybe freelancers know a funder or a commissioner, but that whole gamut of people that are working in this field. And I think it would be lovely if there was more opportunities for all these kind of pillars to come together in some way and discuss what the issues are. I think I was the big thing that jumped out for me from the summary was, I'll read it because it says, all five groups have a responsibility to help build a more equitable and representative sector. All five should, in different ways, develop a level playing field for partnership or co-production to make the work realistic, effective and embedded. And I love that phrase. And there was another bit about actually the drive that kept people going who are delivering our work, what keeps us going is a kind of passionate, often a passionate commitment supported by witnessing often life-changing impacts on others. That was certainly the case for me. And I think it's that driver that has kept a lot of practitioners going, but we need to find other ways of making the work more sustainable.
I mean, I really couldn't agree more with Sue about how this report applies itself to so many different types of people. I think too often we see reports that are aimed at just practitioners or just commissioners. And actually, you know, as Sue says, and as the report reflects, we're all in this together. If we all want the ecosystem of everybody working in this field to be happy, to be productive, to be doing the best and flourishing, then we all need to work together. And I suppose I look at a few of the different aspects, given the sort of different roles that I've worked in. So, you know, I'm a freelance artist as an individual. I also run my own organisation called the Arts and Health Hub, which is supporting artists working in arts and health. And previously, I was the director of an arts charity in the NHS. So I was commissioning artists. So I really see the value of us, you know, really thinking about how we all work together and how to apply all of these recommendations, regardless of what role we work in. And I think the key thing for me is really looking at that aspect of co-production. We can't do this alone, regardless of what sort of role we're in. This is really about working with people, and that's not just the participants that we support through the participatory work, but the artists that we work with, the producers that we work with. Everybody that's involved in working in this sector needs to be working together and asking each other questions about, is this working? If it's not working, then we need to, you know, take that on board and look at some of these recommendations and think about how we can make this sector, I think, more inclusive, more diverse, supporting lived experience, and, you know, implementing better ways of working, implementing best practice that's highlighted in this report.
Thank you so much for sharing your initial thoughts, Sue and Daniel. And you're both spot on about the fact that, yes, the report is meant to, I guess, build a sort of awareness that each one of us has a certain role to play and each one of us is a very important part of the sector. So what I would love to do next is sort of dive deeper into the recommendations that are specifically for practitioners. Was there any specific recommendation that caught your attention? And if so, why?
I think for me, one of the key ones is about being realistic. I think we're in a really, really competitive field. You know, funding is really hard to come by. There's far less opportunities than there are artists and practitioners. So there's this, I think, tendency to overcommit or overpromise. And what that leads to is eventually burnout and frustration and resentment about the work that we're doing. Sometimes that's, you know, our own doing, that we've written into a funding bid that we're going to deliver all of this work for the smallest amount of money. And I think myself as a practitioner and the work that I do through the Arts and Health Hub is really thinking about how do we take care of ourselves as practitioners? You know, what is fair pay? What are we going to do for that day rate? And what are we not going to do? And thinking about what feels realistic. You know, what can we actually achieve with this amount of money and with this amount of human resource in terms of our partners who are supporting us? So for me, that feels so important to remind practitioners, you know, it's for your own good to be realistic about what you can achieve with what you have. And the second is really about not going it alone. For me, I know that my practice, when I'm not working with other people, but I'm in my studio, is really solitary. And sometimes that's amazing because I only want to be alone when I'm making work because my work is really deeply personal, often about mental health and often about my own lived experience. But that does mean that there's a sense of loneliness and isolation there. So having a peer group of other artists that make work around similar themes to me is really important, and having that peer-to-peer support. And if I am working on a project with partners, it's about keeping up that communication, making sure that I know who I can check in with and how I can check in with them. If I need additional support because the work is complex and demanding and emotionally taxing, making sure that I have that emotional support in place before I start on a project. So really thinking about the whole duration of the project and the potential impact it might have on me. I think that we are often, quite rightly, thinking about the safeguarding of participants, but we forget about ourselves as practitioners, and we are human beings. The work that we do has an impact on us. So making sure that we're not doing that alone is really, really important. And that's something I think is really important to emphasize, not only to practitioners, but also to commissioners and our partners that we're working with, so that they can think about how to support us throughout the types of work that we do.
I couldn't agree more, Danielle. This podcast is going to be interesting with us agreeing about everything. That sense, I just underline, don't try to achieve everything in one project. And the points you made about being realistic are so, so important. You can start a programme with that sense of realism. And if you're with a team of people that are just hugely committed to the work, then I think sometimes that desire to want to absolutely do everything can just people... You can be very clear that this is the fee, this is what's to be delivered, we're all going to agree to do this, and then you can easily get sparked by the excitement of the work. So I think it's really important that we find places where we can communicate with each other, almost like the little angel on your shoulder saying, are you sure? You need to just stop, you know, or, you know, who's the person that's telling the project manager that's managing the team of artists or freelancers to just pull the reins back and stop them being so super enthusiastic and giving that extra time. So I often find myself trying to kind of chip in and just say, stop, or have you thought about that, just as a kind of reminder, a reminding friend. So the thing that came out to me was really the support element. Quite often when I've been talking to the NHS about the support for artists, there's been a nervousness about, because it's kind of like, well, we can't give you clinical support because you're not clinicians. And I've had to kind of demystify that and say, no, but we're working in the same field, often with complex mental health issues, and everyone needs supporting in different ways. So rather than the NHS providing a clinical psychologist, we look at other ways of doing it. Some of us have been doing some reflective practice work and providing a more of a bespoke framework for artists, as in what works for each individual, and reminding them that an offer is there. I think it's certainly an area that needs to be developed and grown when you're working in partnership with trusts, that sense that, and I would really welcome the opportunity to kind of sit in a mixed clinical team to just unpick some of the some of the challenges because artists aren't trained with barriers. Quite often we're coming with our own lived experience and we want to share. So ensuring that we don't overshare, that we create healthy barriers. And as the report says, the work is hugely rewarding, but it can also be really demanding. And finding a space where you can feel that you can be part of a larger movement for change, but you're supported within it, I just think is really, really, and I've had to constantly remind people to to take time out. And I, the last program I did, we carved a decent amount in the budget for artists' wellbeing. And I've watched people say, no, I'm fine. And I could see them struggling. I don't know, it's almost like a culture that we artists have got so used to overworking to achieve and do their very best that they've forgotten that their well-being is really important. And if you're in it for the duration like we've been, I think you certainly see that it takes its toll. So you need to really embed healthy practice right from the very beginning.
I think in the report there's something Sue, around what brings people to this sector, and there's, I think it's 40% of people coming into kind of the arts and mental health sector through their own lived experience. And that wasn't a surprise to me, but it does flag up, as you say, some complexities, I think, that just because we have lived experience and we're drawn to this sector doesn't mean that we have the professional and interpersonal skills to be able to do the work that we do. That's really complex. It does involve working with people and listening to really difficult stories. Yeah. And I suppose the training that you would get as a therapist or a clinician enables you to enact boundaries and know when it is useful or not useful to share parts of yourself in order to help that person grow. And that's something that we don't get in arts education. In my BA and MA, there was absolutely no education around participatory arts practice. And I find it really interesting that we spend a lot of time working with people and vulnerable groups, but there's very little in terms of the training, and there's very little in terms of the support that we're offered when we are essentially, working in clinical spaces, working with vulnerable people, listening to really difficult stories, but are offered no support in the way that we process the things that we're hearing.
Yeah, I think my experience is informed by, I took a little bit of time out of my practice to work on a mental health research programme, which was part-time. And actually, for the first time, got some proper clinical supervision. We were listening to really challenging stories online from other carers. And it opened a new door to me in terms of what might be possible and just that personal understanding. Obviously, I think most artists have got that sense of self-reflection and some form of kind of emotional intelligence that just naturally comes with the development of their work. But I think we're not used to making the time or understanding the need to really process it, perhaps until it's a bit late and you're starting to feel a bit stressed or you're not sleeping. And we shouldn't actually have to get to that. I'm sat here now with kind of 26 years experience of participatory work, and I feel I'm using every single experience from the past to inform the work that I'm delivering, because it like you say, Danielle, it can be really complex because people are people, everybody's different, groups, people come together, and it's a joy to kind of be able to facilitate and manage that, but it's actually quite complex work.
And unsurprisingly, I think one of the things that came out very often through the discussions that we were having while putting this report together was the need for better training, the need for creating space to nurture your own self. And I think, like you mentioned, Danielle, I think because it's such a competitive space where everybody's fighting to get some pot of funding, I think we're so busy thinking about what can make this project look viable, that we tend not to book in time of reflective space, self-reflection, just that self-care routine. Because when you're working with communities, like both of you mentioned, it can be really exhausting. And as a practitioner, I've often found that you're working on multiple projects and you've just not given yourself enough time to sort of settle in with what just happened, the conversations that were discussed in a specific session. And before you could you can sort of process all that, you're jumping to the next project. And that obviously takes a toll on your own personal health. So thank you so much for highlighting some excellent practices that both of you are implementing within your projects. And I'm sure that practitioners who've tuned in right now can understand and completely agree with everything that you all have to share. So thank you very much for that. And like you mentioned right at the start, Sue, about this report, I think one of the key things for us has been, what next? How do we practically embed these recommendations? How would you go about, or how do you think you would suggest someone else to go about actually implementing these recommendations?
Yeah, it's a big question. And I think some of the, I was thinking about, we've just got some funding from the AHRC to run a program called, well, we haven't got it, Lancaster University, we're successful in it, to look at how the type of social prescribing work we've been doing can address health inequalities. And within that, there's going to be a series of focus groups from across those five areas. It's not quite the same, but I think some sort of model where you could bring people together to have really open discussions about what the, I'm thinking maybe, yeah, some, it might be a research program that where we can really get together and honestly and openly tackle what the challenges are, what the opportunities are, because we've all got an investment in the work. Presumably we all care deeply about the work that we're doing, so why not come together and try and make something even better happen? My sense is it's some really great work going on across the country, but it's quite patchy, and there's just so much we can learn from each other and from the good practice that is existing. It needs to kind of grow and flourish, and the right environments needs to be created for seeds of those seeds to be kind of nourished and developed. And just on a really kind of practical level, I've just given out some really small notebooks for artists. Their well-being wasn't particularly embedded, although everyone says they care about it. And I thought, I don't want to ask them to do a diary because it'll be like extra work. So I just gave them a little gift when I did some training with them, and just sort of said, use this however you want to use it, but it's for you. And it's for you to note significant moments. So it could be really positive or really negative. But just so that you've got a little record and you've spent time kind of working on processing those feelings. Because I was getting kind of texts and messages from some of the artists I was supporting that really needed to kind of express that. And I thought it'd be great if they had their own journal that was for them, that wasn't for them. Maybe it'll feed into a discussion or evaluation at the end, but it's absolutely on their terms. So there's two examples there. A large national kind of, let's come together and make this work, and a very kind of small scale, what can we do practically when resources aren't there?
I think I see these kind of reports and documents real like leverage for practitioners. So in the same way that I recommend to artists to use documents like Artists Union England's rates of pay document when they're being commissioned for works, and actually they're not quite sure what their rate of pay should be, and they can go back to the organisation that they're working with and can say, well, actually, look at this document, you know, your pay is not matching up to the recommended sort of pay scale from my experience. These kind of reports, especially when they have the weight of organisations like the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance, I think they're really, really useful in leveraging the ways that we need and want to work. And I say need and want because this is how we should be working. If the situation and the experience that we're having doesn't meet these recommendations, then we should be able to use this report and go back to organisations and say, well, actually, you know, it is recommended that I have support because I am doing complex work. Because often I think artists feel really nervous about speaking up as an individual. They're worried about being marginalised and being seen as somebody that's difficult because there'll be a million other artists that can do this work who don't ask these questions. But we do ourselves and we do our sector a disservice by not speaking up. And I know for myself as a practitioner, I won't accept bad pay. I won't work on a project that's working with vulnerable communities as a person with, you know, my own difficulties without support. And I'm able and confident to speak up as an individual, but I can rely on documents and reports like these as my backing to say, actually, you know, this work is really complex. This work is difficult. And these are the things that our sector is encouraging suggesting that we have in place in order to do this work, in order to flourish. And really, that's what I'm looking for when I'm doing this work, is that I want to do this work and I want to be happy and I want to flourish. I don't want to do this work and be really stressful. I don't want to go home and be ruminating about the experiences I'm having through work, because that's work. You know, that's, I shouldn't be having a stressful experience. I should have the space to feel supported in terms of the practical aspects, but also the emotional and affective support that I need to process this. So these reports are so useful, and the fact that it's geared towards so many different stakeholders, I think it's really, really great that artists can use this to speak up. The commissioners should be considering what kind of support they should be offering. It's such a valuable asset and tool, I think, for us.
Wow, such golden words. I feel like we can go on and on with this conversation. But honestly, there's just so much that has come out from this conversation, so many valuable thoughts from both of you. And I completely agree with you, Danielle. I think this report could be used as like your base, regardless of the group that you belong to, just to understand what is relevant, what is important, what is realistic, and then sort of use that as a tool to build your own confidence to speak up. So thank you so much, both of you, for honestly being so amazing and practical with your experiences and sharing such amazing thoughts. On a very lighter note, as we come to the end of this conversation, I thought it would be nice to, well, I thought it would be fun. I'm not sure whether you both think it's fun, but I thought it'd be fun to just ask you a very random question. If you ever had, so do you want to go first?
Okay. Well, the first thing that sprung to my mind was working from the outside in. There was something about always being on the periphery, but desperately trying to make affect positive change inside in within kind of health and social systems. I don't know whether it's a great title. I always think with titles you spend a long time. You either get a really good one straight off, or you'll write 20 or 30 and then pick one, and then someone walks in the room and goes, oh, that's a so-and-so, and you go, yeah, that's what I'm going to use. So titles are difficult, but yeah, that's what sprang to mind, working from the outside in.
Sue, let me know when it hits the shelves, I'll read it. I think mine would be pick your own path, because I think I had, up until a few years ago, lots of complexes around being an unwell person all throughout my teens and my 20s. And I made lots of comparisons to my peers, thinking, you know, after they finished university, they straight away did this. And I spent all of my 20s in and out of mental health care and feeling like I was behind. And actually, I'm not behind at all. I'm just on a very different path. It's a special, unique journey. And I encourage that way of thinking for other artists and human beings, that, you know, if we make comparisons, then we start to feel that we're less than. But if we start to realize actually we're all on our own journey and our own paths and our own timelines, then you don't need to compare yourself to anybody or anything. So pick your own path is mine.
Amazing. I'm definitely going to read both these books as and when they are released. Thank you very much for indulging in my randomness, and such profound thoughts are coming out through this conversation. I'm absolutely loving it. However, we do need to conclude the conversation at some point. So do either of you have any sort of final thoughts around the report or around your practice? Just any final thoughts at all?
Yeah, I think I wanted to reflect on what Daniel said about it is a real privilege to be a professional artist, but having a personal set of rules. So, you know, the report talks about flourishing and how we develop a thriving practice in an open and inclusive way. So placing yourself within the centre of that and using your creative practice to work out where you sit and where you want to be amongst that that complex framework, really, that we all work in, is something that I think is really important for artists.
Yeah, I think, you know, I often think life is already hard enough that I don't want to be an artist that is struggling. You know, I'm not buying into this trope of the struggling artist. I'm just not here for it. So for me, it's about having boundaries and really clear set of criteria of what I need to be able to do this work. I want to love working in this field. That's why I discovered being a creative. It gave me something. It enriched me. It nourished me. So it doesn't matter whether I'm creating just for myself or I'm being creative and working with other people. I need a set of standards in order to love doing this work. And I'm not willing to settle for anything less. So I will turn down work if it doesn't meet my standards in the same way that anybody working in any other sector would. I'm just not willing to put myself on the line and put my health on the line for the sake of taking on another job. And if that means I don't have, you know, work for a while, then that's fine, because all it means is that I have more time to invest in myself and finding the work that I want. There's nothing worse than being resentful about working on a really terrible, low-paid job with no support, listening to other people's problems. You know, that's just not what I'm here for. So I think the report really gives you like standards of ways of working, whether you're a practitioner or whether you're a commissioner. It's really setting the standard for how we all need to work in the sector. And I hope that it encourages artists to think about this. When we take on a piece of work and a project, you know, what are the things that we need to be able to flourish? And I think that's a really important word. You know, we should all be flourishing in this sector, not struggling, not suffering. There's enough suffering going on in the world. We don't need that in the work that we do.
Wow, that's been absolutely inspirational. I feel like I'm talking to such role models. And thank you so much for being so generous with your thoughts and with your ideas. I think you're so right there, Daniel, about there is great power in saying no, and it is okay to say no, thank you. I think very often we can feel like we need to say yes to everything and bring it on, but you can't serve from an empty well. So you need to have that time for yourself to nourish yourself. So thank you so much, both of you. Honestly, I have learned so much, and I'm sure everybody who's tuned in has learned a great deal as well. So thank you once again for joining us in this conversation.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you, Sue.
Wow. So much richness, depth, and honesty in these conversations. I hope you have enjoyed this conversation with Daniel and Sue as much as I have. I would also definitely recommend grabbing hold of a pen and paper and jotting down your key reflections or your key learnings from this conversation. I find that a great way of creating value for yourself. And of course, if you would like to find out more about this report, then please do head to the website culturehealthandwellbeing.org.uk. That's where you can download the report as well as sign up for our newsletters to find out and keep in touch with all the latest from the arts, health, and wellbeing space. Thank you so much for tuning in. We have more episodes coming up in this series, so please keep an eye out on the website. And here is wishing you a creative, positive, and fulfilling day ahead. Thank you, and have a good one. These podcasts are designed and delivered by the Culture, Health, and Wellbeing Alliance, and kindly funded by the Baring Foundation.